Hey, you're listening to the Words on Flicks show with me, Janine Coveney.
You're listening to the Words on Flicks show on eWater Radio. KEWR-DB.
The views and comments expressed do not reflect the opinions of eWater Radio. All comments and views are show guest views and comments and in no way reflect views or comments of eWater Radio, KEWR-DB, or its affiliates.
Welcome, Words on Flicks fans and friends, to the December 2023 edition of the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. We have a great show for you with three very special guests to talk about some of the biggest films of the year. And let me tell you a little bit more about them. My first guest is Anita M. Samuels. Anita M. Samuels is a nationally acclaimed journalist and critic who writes about media, fashion, music, and culture. Samuels has been an editor for national publications, including BET Weekend, Billboard, Heart and Soul, Impact Radio, Records, and Retail Weekly. Her stories have appeared in Essence, The Source, Consumer Digest, Global Rhythm Magazine, The Asbury Park Press, Upscale, Honey, Code, Karrebeat, Forum, Child Magazine, Fierce for Black Women, and DiverseBusinessNews.com, among others. She's also the author of Rants and Retorts, How Bigots Got a Monopoly on Commenting About News Online. All right, my girl Anita. And you should be familiar with my brother, A. Scott Galloway. He's a prolific Los Angeles-based music journalist who has been writing about music since 1988 for magazines that include Urban Network, Wax Poetics, and the UK's Blues and Soul, interviewing artists from Max Roach to Maxwell. His specialty niche is composing liner notes essays for reissues and compilations of classic recordings, for which he has written more than 300. Then we have Derek Thompson. He is a previous guest on the podcast. Derek is a writer, director, and producer who co-founded Nailbiter Productions, a company specializing in digital and original scripted television content. The company's first web series, Romp, is currently available for viewing on YouTube. Thompson's background is in the music industry, with stints at both Def Jam and EMI, working with the likes of LL Cool J and Arrested Development. Eventually, Derek found his way to the then newly formed BMG Music Publishing, where he eventually became Senior Vice President of Talent and oversaw the company's expanding R&B hip-hop roster. During his successful tenure at BMG, he brought the likes of Mobb Deep, Nelly, Erykah Badu, and Lupe Fiasco into the BMG Music Publishing family. He is a big fan of movies, as we all are, so I hope you enjoy our wide-ranging conversation. Thanks for listening.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, here we are. Welcome to the Words on Flicks show. I've got a great panel here today to talk about some of our favorite films of 2023. But really, this is just an excuse for us to really go in deep on one of my favorite films of the year, and it probably is yours, which is American Fiction, which is just coming to theaters in major cities. It just came out this past weekend, and it's going to go wide in the coming week. So welcome, journalist Anita M. Samuels.
Hello. How's everybody?
And then I have my friend and long esteemed colleague, Mr. A. Scott Galloway from Los Angeles, who's been on the show. Welcome, Scott.
Hello, everybody. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you, Nini.
And then, of course, I have my other longtime friend and associate and music industry colleague, who is now a writer and content creator, Mr. Derek Thompson. Thanks for coming back, Derek.
Happy holidays to everybody.
So I am going to dive right in because I think this is the picture. This is the flick that everybody's going to be talking about. It's going to make a big impact, we hope and pray, and maybe get some awards recognition for the actors. And that is the film American Fiction, directed by Cord Jefferson. This is his first time directing his own script. It's an adaptation of the Percival Everett novel, Erasure. And Percival Everett is a novelist I happen to love. And he has a unique writing approach. So he often uses satire and a bit of the absurd to make his points. So where do we begin? Scott, you just saw it yesterday.
Yeah, I saw it in a theater in Burbank. And oh my goodness, I mean, everybody was very enthralled with it. It was probably about half full house on a Saturday afternoon. All I can say is wow. You know, I love the casting. I love the story. I love the layered depth of relationships, family, love, romances. Of course, the main part of it is, writing this book after writing a lot of wonderful pieces that didn't really get much attention or sales. And he, you know, we know the story. He writes a book that just pandered to the lowest common denominator, and it just becomes a sensation, and he's appalled.
Right. He was trying to make it's proving his point, right, that black trauma porn is what is really selling in the publishing market. And so he writes this completely ridiculous, stereotypical book, and it blows up. Which is something all of us can relate to as writers, right? We're all writing in the current, atmosphere, landscape of the media world. And we're all struggling with this on certain levels, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, for me, I don't do fiction, so I don't have the same issues that he had. But I certainly see it in the music world, you know, just in, you know, the kind of records that are really popular versus some really great things that don't get attention. So it kind of, even though this is dealing with the literary world, it's something that we see, you know, across the board as far as the pandering and, you know, whatever is easiest for a mass audience to digest.
Right. So, Anita, you've seen it twice, I believe.
No, I actually didn't get to see it a second time.
Okay.
But it's definitely a topic that Black academics and Black journalists struggle with on a daily basis. I know how I have. Mm-hmm. I don't write about the negative Black aspects of our lives. I write about the most positive things that I can find, and mostly to educate and to teach, not just other people, but also myself, because there's so much that we don't know, mm-hmm. you know, about ourselves. So that's why I try to do that. But I like the film, and the theater that I was in, I would say that the group was more white than Black here in Park Slope, Brooklyn. And every time it got to a scene where, you know, it was laughable, I was kind of cringing a little bit, because I'm like, okay.
Why are they laughing?
Why are they laughing?
And we know why we're laughing.
Laughing, exactly. I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Was it that funny? Wasn't that funny when he was writing, you know, and the characters are appearing and he's writing it and they're acting out what he's writing? Was it that funny, or was it kind of scary? Like, wow, this is how we're viewed.
Yeah,
that was real. The very little part of the film is him writing, and then the characters are right there in the room with him and asking him what their next lines are. I was like, I'd never seen that before. That was kind of a new device for me. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
No, it was. And I read something in the Times about saying that he didn't want to keep it going. He just wanted that small part, and he ended it there, and we never saw any more of that.
But back to Scott talking about how you don't write fiction necessarily, but Cord Jefferson used to be a journalist. And in there was a huge press conference that I was privy to online, where they had almost the entire cast on stage, including Cord Jefferson. And Cord was talking about how he got out of journalism because every time there was a shooting, a police killing of a Black person, some kind of tragedy involving Black people, they were like, here's your assignment. Here's your story. Can you write this up for us? And he just said, I just got tired of being the go-to person for Black trauma news. And that is something that I'm sure is relatable to anybody who has had to do news. I mean, we've done music, so.
I think that we just have a tendency in this country to like categorize and pigeonhole things. And that's what this really spoke to me about. First of all, thank you, Janine, because I had a wonderful seat at the New York screening, and I had no idea that Cord Jefferson and the entire cast were going to be there.
I didn't know that.
I thought I was just going to a random screening, and I pull up, and there's like barricades and limousines, and I'm like, what is going on here? But anyway, I just want to say a couple things. First of all, I'm so happy to see Jeffrey Wright get flowers. Jeffrey Wright has been putting in the work for decades.
Yes.
And has always been underrated. And I cannot imagine anybody else playing this role. I thought it was fantastic from beginning to end. My takeaway was, I thought it was a perfect blending and script-wise blending of kind of silliness meets seriousness. I thought like the making of the book thing was the book, the fake book was kind of like the silly part, but the dynamics in the family.
Yes.
And like the mother getting older and not being there. And then Jeffrey Wright's character, you know, he didn't even know that his dad was having an affair because he had taken himself out of the loop and he had become an outsider. And it was his fault. He didn't know what was going on. And so I thought that was great. And then I thought the dynamic of the Sterling K. Brown character was hilarious. And I thought that one of the surprising scenes, which because you asked us earlier about our two favorite scenes, and one of mine was the reaction that Lorraine and Maynard, who are getting married, how they are very accepting when they come into the house. Like you would think that they were going to be like completely like go off and be like, what is going on here? Get him out of here. But they were the accepting ones. And Jeffrey Wright's character was the one that was like, I can't deal with this. And I thought that was a great dynamic. It was really a powerful movie.
It is.
I mean, the family aspects were just, that's a TV series I could probably watch. You know, I mean, I was really into all of those characters, man. It was great.
And just seeing Leslie Uggams, you know, who is a legend. I mean, just the casting of the entire film, you know, when they received the script, and I don't know if they talked about this, the talk session that you saw, Derek, but they were saying that when they first got the script, it was actually called the second title of the book that starts with F.
Oh, wow.
No, that's what the script was called. And they were like, you know, what is this going to be? But also the family dynamics, you know, with Tracy Ellis Ross as the sister who was bearing the brunt of what was going on with their aging parent. We all are in that sandwich generation of dealing with older parents, and they're in various stages, burying the ones we love, the sibling dynamic of joshing each other. But what I also loved was the love between the two older characters who actually got married. That was how often do we see that? Yeah. Amazing. When Maynard rolled out and he was like, Lorraine, I was like, okay. He's in love his feelings.
Yeah, rekindled love that got a second chance, and they didn't waste a second. They hooked right up, and that was beautiful. So many, just like I said, such a layered, so many things going on in that movie. And we got to be careful of spoilers, but it was so wonderful. I can't.
I don't want to spoil anything either, but like Anita, I too want to see, I need to see it again, because my other favorite scene is when the authors are in the jury, and it's the scene between Issa and Jeffrey.
That scene
is so powerful.
And
I really want to see line by line what they said, because I forgot. I mean, I know I got the gist of it, but I forget some of the specific lines they said, because those lines were biting and cutting, because we as the audience, we know that both those books are really full of crap. And Jeffrey Wright knows that his book is full of crap. But Issa really thinks that her character thinks that she really put in the work, even though, you know, her book is kind of full of it as well. But that dynamic, that back and forth between the two of them, was my other favorite scene in the whole movie.
That to me was, okay, so we have these two stories side by side. We have the family story of what Thelonious Ellison is going through. And then we have this publishing story And that, to me, that scene with the two of them, the only two Black writers on on this jury of judging literary work for the year, that is a really pivotal scene because, and Cord Jefferson even said he did not want to vilify Issa's character or other writers, you know, who are out here doing their thing. Like, they have audiences. Okay, it is a legitimate genre of literature. And she's like, yeah, I did the work. I defend it. I stand. It's not that it isn't real. And Thelonious is like, you know, Monk is like, I just don't want people to think that's all we are. So
we lives in the ghetto.
we's lived in the ghetto.
Oh my God.
Janine, I have to tell you though, I really was surprised that they, when they were sitting in the room together, I was like, okay, they're going to be agreeing with each other or something like that. I fully did not expect the way that it ended up working out. And I thought that was really interesting because I just assumed, oh, they'll get together and be like, oh, yeah, we can agree with this and that. They did not. They were polar opposites. And it's like, you know, no. And I thought, too, because she was a woman, I thought that was really interesting how she was able to, on her own, speak her piece. Exactly. As a Black female author.
Exactly. Exactly.
And not only that, she was the only person speaking sense in a way within that entire jury, right? She, to Monk's surprise, is really the voice of reason in that whole process, right?
Yes. Yes.
So that part was interesting.
I was going to say just real quickly, it's really hilarious. And again, not to give away too much, but when they announced that he's won, her reaction is so priceless to me because she is like this. Oh my God. Right.
I know. But let me just roll back for a minute because, again, this movie is packed with so much and it does merit, you know, multiple viewings.
Definitely.
And I think for those of us, you know, whatever realm that you're in and whatever your experience is, you can pull something out of it, but here, that the fact that the main character is an academic and a writer, so will everyone understand that his very name has historical impact, right? Like, his name is Thelonious Ellison, paying tribute to the jazz great Thelonious Monk, who was one of the most influential jazz composers and pianists ever, and that's why he has the same nickname, Monkey, right? They call him
Monk. Yeah, Monkey.
And Ralph Ellison, the African American writer who wrote the classic 1952 novel The Invisible Man, for which he became the first Black person to win the National Book Award. So, you know, people might hear the name and think it's familiar. For other people, they won't get the references. I mean, you know, we know our generations, our younger people might not get it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that Anita reminded me of, but I did know, is the fact that Monk uses a specific pseudonym, right? Stag R. Lee.
Stag R. Lee, right. Stag R.
Right.
Lee. Yeah. So... Anita, we were looking up who Stag R. Lee is the other day, so.
Right. The song from Lloyd Price.
That's right.
And, you know, it's a true story, which is.
Right. He's like this mythic Black figure, Stag Lee. Like, I was shocked to discover that this tale, this legend of Stag Lee, Stag R. Lee, Stagger Lee, however you want to say it, goes back more than a century. It's like based on a real person who was in a violent incident from 1895, and they're singing about him. So
he stole a hat and he shot somebody. I think in the reverse order, something like that.
And then the other thing that I learned in looking at the Stag Lee song, okay, so we thought hip hop had, you know, the clean version and the dirty version. There are two versions of the Lloyd Price song, and there is the original version, which tells this true story, and there is a bandstand version in which Stag Lee and Billy are fighting over a girlfriend, and Stag Lee doesn't want to be not friends with Billy anymore, so he gives him back his money and his girlfriend, and they make up. That makes no sense, but I heard it. I actually heard it. So anyway, so let's talk about the casting. We've already talked about how great Jeffrey Wright is.
Yes.
And, you know, this is a role that really, really suits him. And he even said in the press conference that he felt that the role was really suited to him, that he had so many similarities.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But Tracy Ellis Ross, she wasn't even in the movie that long.
That's what I said. That was my takeaway.
Like, what happened?
What do you mean, what happened?
No, I mean, I'm saying, what happened? Why wasn't she in? Why was it?
You don't remember the story, huh? We don't want to give it away.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I know what happened to her, but what I was saying is, like, I was surprised her role was so short.
And, yeah.
But,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Then I wondered too that, you know, did was that meant to come with, or was it the result of the stress of being the sole, I want to say, I guess, caretaker of their mother, the stress of that? Because as we know, that is very stressful when only one of the siblings is in charge of, you know, the mother and everything, or whatever else she was going through, her divorce and all of that.
Right.
And that it was the woman, the sister, that ended up bearing the brunt of all that. Neither one of the brothers, it was the their sister that had to do that, which is kind of it's common, and but it's also stereotypical and all that, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I just want to say that, to go back to Issa for a second, the character name of Sinatra Golden is probably one of the all-time great character names that he could have possibly come up with. So I thought that was really, really funny. And it was also great to see Erica Alexander on screen.
I love her.
Yeah.
There's so much. And even the cinematography, I thought, looked great. Like, when do you see Black folks in Massachusetts?
On the beach house, yes. The beach
two
house.
Two homes,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Family of doctors. It just, to me, it looked beautiful. I thought the music was great. Even the supporting actors, like his agent. I don't think I've ever seen that guy who played his agent in another movie. Maybe I have, but I never noticed.
I definitely remember his face.
Yeah, what was the name of the film about Hector Laveau? What was that film? He played, not Tito Puente, I can't remember the name of the person, but he was in that movie.
El Cantante.
Yeah, that one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
That was a mess of a film, but we're not discussing that here.
You know what, Janine, too, though, one of the things that I thought was really interesting, too, is so when we think of Black wealth, you know, they have wealth, you know, they were doctors in the family and all that kind of stuff. What I thought was pretty significant was Myra's role. She was the housekeeper. When she first comes into the scene, you assume that she's a relative, like, you know, an aunt or a sister or somebody. But she's a housekeeper, and she's so ingrained in the family that you don't even view her as that. And I guess it made me think, too, that I never thought of the help as it applies to Black wealth and Black families. So I thought that was interesting.
That was pivotal in the scene that came later, too, when the brother was with his lover or whatever, and she is the one that embraced him and told him, you know, you're not a problem, you're not a whatever, you're family. You know, and shoulders and hugs him. And so all of that was very important.
It was like she was in charge almost, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. She was the alternate matriarch of the family. That is her role at the end of the movie. I just need to confess that on my second viewing of the film, I really thought more about Monk's character, his stepping away from his family, being a writer, being so interior, being aloof, keeping people away is something that I relate to in myself.
Yeah, me too.
Which really made me rethink, you know, how I live with my family, okay? But I'm always fighting for solo time so I can get in my head and listen to my music and think about my podcast and do my readings and write what I have to write. And sometimes being a writer, you can't help but separate yourself from people. But sometimes you do tend to miss things or not really respond as well as you could to the outside world. So that's something that really made me reflect
I think there's so many creative people, especially creative Black people that I know who have had that similar journey, whether it be a writer or actor or singer or whatever. Like, you know, your family is one way, then you leave home to go out and, you know, see the world and pursue the dreams. And you don't really set out to really, quote unquote, distance yourself, but it just happens. And you become a bit, you know, distant, and you're not as present. And so you don't know, you know, maybe you forget a birthday, a family member's birthday or a graduation or something like that, because you're pursuing your own dreams. And so you wake up one day and you're like, wow, like I kind of missed out. Like I am the outsider now, like unintentionally, but I am the outsider.
It's the byproduct of being a creative. You know, creative people need that space and that time.
Space, exactly. Yes.
Vibe, whereas, you know, everyone else was doctors. He was the one that had the different vibe going on. And so that's what called for that. Yeah.
And I love Sterling K. Brown. I mean, the last couple of things I've seen him in, he just goes all out in his characterization. And I loved it. I wondered if maybe it was stereotypical, but, you know, it was a unique character, I thought. And some of those scenes were improvised, like some of the ribbing that they did with each other was totally improvised.
No, I would say his character was completely stereotypical, because I mean, they made him, you know, he did have the flash and all that, but you know, he had some very tender moments and very kind of quiet moments. He wasn't Robin Williams in the Birdcage, you know? but he did have a couple of
But remember also he had to make up time. Like he had been in a straight relationship. We'd have, you know, a wife and kids and all that, and he was like, this is not even who I am. Let me get out and party right now.
Yeah.
I loved his sentence when he and his brother were in the dining room and they were talking about being doctors and, you know, prescribing. And he said to his brother, Monk said, I'm not that kind of doctor. He's like, we might need you to revive a sentence.
Yeah.
So could this movie have been made 10 years ago? And could it have been made 10 years from now? These are issues historically, right, that we've been facing in this country of being stereotyped or seeing in as a monolith and all of that, right?
Yeah.
I could have been made in the past. Spike Lee, you know, I was just about to say that. But yeah, that's it. I mean, you know, I didn't feel like it was that revolutionary. I'm just happy that it was made, you know, that it was made now. Yeah, it could have been made before, but I'm so happy that we're having these kind of movies now, you know, that are layered and intelligent and thoughtful, still funny, still sexy, all that. Mm-hmm. And I always look at She's Got to Have It as kind of opening the door for us to have real characters that are flawed and multifaceted and but still incredibly compelling, you know, that, you know, and not stereotypical. Sitting in the theater yesterday, I was just I had this really warm feeling that it's just great that we could have a movie like this, you know, that I get to have one of these this Christmas, because I can't tell you how many Christmases there weren't any movies like this for us. Or it'd be, you know, and I like The Best Man, but, you know, it'd be the Best Man holiday or whatever. And so you got that.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's two different things, yeah.
This was wonderful at this time of year and in this time of life as well. Just like Janine was saying, we're all right in this.
Yeah.
With dealing with parents, dealing with career, dealing with identity, dealing with being taken seriously and all those things. It just kind of hits, you know, hit me anyway, in a very personal place, very, you know, like right now, like just, it's just right on time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So thumbs up across the board from all of us, I would say.
Absolutely.
Any final thoughts, Anita? Anything that you wanted to add?
I mean, I'm happy that this type of film has been made, but, you know, like you had told me, you know, Jeffrey Wright was saying that this film is proof that moving away from Black trauma porn, I mean, yeah, that's probably true, but what remains to be seen is whether filmmakers will contribute to this as a new trend in filmmaking. It may not be considered new, and whether Hollywood executives are actually going to fund something like this. You know, this is the second film that I've seen related to book publishing. The other one is not like major film, but it's actually on a streaming platform called The Other Black Girl. Mm. And that is about book publishing too, but it turns out to be like a cult where Black girls, using hair grease as a metaphor, is used in this cult to get Black women to stop complaining about how tough it is for them in the industry. So in order to be successful, you rub this grease in your head and you become different.
Wow.
So I don't know how it's going to work. And even with the bidding, with the amount of money that he got, that Monk got for the film, Zakiya Harris wrote the book, which this
The Other Black Girl
adaptation is adapted to, The Other Black Girl. She got paid $1 million for this, okay? And she was able to have it, like Monk, turned into, you know, a film. In her case, it's a streaming episode on Hulu. But it's like, okay, so this is where we are now.
Well, I think it's going to, my final thought would be, it's going to be very telling what the first week box office is for the film. And that'll probably, you know, we'll be able to see, will there be more American Fictions made, or will this be just like a kind of, you know, one-off situation? But I think there's definitely going to be in the Oscar race, without a doubt. And I think that's going to shine a spotlight on the fact that, because this reminded me, I agree with everything that Scott said earlier about when I sat down and after the lights came up at the screening, I immediately thought of the first time I saw, like you said, Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It. That's what it was like. It was different. It was unexpected. It was something you were like, wow, I never thought that I would see a movie like this. And this was kind of my reaction when I left the theater last week for this one too. So we'll see.
Awesome. I actually showed it to my mother. She loved it. My mother is, well, she's in her 80s. We'll just leave it at that. And she got so much out of it. So, you know, we'll see. So everybody go see it, support American Fiction, and hopefully we'll see it represented in the race, because I was so disappointed. Was it last year or the year before when Woman King got totally overlooked? And I thought that was a fantastic movie also, but I digress. So there's certainly other movies out as we come into, you know, the end of the year. And I think the other movie that I know Derek and I have talked about and really got a big buzz because directed by Martin Scorsese, who is a major filmmaker, which is Killers of the Flower Moon. And I talked somewhat about it on my last podcast. It is a major film achievement, no doubt. It is a film about basically in 1920s Oklahoma, sort of, what would you say, the abuse, the swindling, the decimation of
all of that, yes.
Of the Osage tribe
who
had become enriched when oil was discovered on their land. And
also in a state, mind you, not too far away from where the Tulsa Black Wall Street Massacre happened. So that's what
Yes. Yeah. And so you even see a scene in the movie where they're looking at, there's people in the movie theater. And I think at that point, it was still silent films. They hadn't even switched to talkies yet. But they are showing a newsreel reporting on the Tulsa Massacre. And the Osage are like, are we next, you know?
Are we next, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Derek, how did the film leave you, strike you?
You know, listen, I don't consider myself as the film critic per se. I like movies, so I go to see movies. But I'm always like, because I have such a short attention span sometimes. And so when I see 3.5 hours before I even go in, I'm like nervous. I'm like, how am I going to get through this? And I got to say, it just kind of goes by as a sweeping, breathtaking story that you can follow from beginning to end. And the way it's shot is so beautiful and the performances are so beautiful. And I was fully engaged from the opening credits to that last scene, which is so powerful with the Indian Nation, the ritual, the burial ritual happening. I thought it was just phenomenal. I thought it was absolutely phenomenal. So I understand all the high praise that it's getting. And you know what? It's Martin Scorsese. And you can't go wrong with Martin Scorsese. So
yeah. Right. That's interesting because I'm telling you, I felt my life pass before my eyes as I was watching this movie. It just went on and on and on. Yeah. And I think, you know, you have white characters who are basically pretending to be friendly with supportive, caring, yeah. Mm-hmm. Embedded into the Osage tribe, and they're all doing all this skulduggery. They're lying to these people's faces, and it's just so blatant mm-hmm. and violent that mm-hmm. it kind of made me sink down in my seat. So by mm-hmm. the time that the film gets to the point of retribution, where there is an FBI agent that comes out to investigate all the deaths, you know, the mysterious deaths of Osage Indians, I was just like, how can this be made right? There is no justice. Yes,
right.
They can imprison these people, they can stop them in their tracks, but the serious damage has been done. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the story, and also I was confused by Leonardo DiCaprio's character, who weds an Osage woman and has children with her, is part of the family, claims to love her, and yet is an agent in his uncle's schemes and plans to basically wipe out the entire family.
He's totally corrupted by the uncle, by Robert De Niro, totally corrupted by it. Because I don't think when he arrived from wherever he came from, I think he was a good person when he got off the train initially. Right. I don't think he came to, like, you know, be the evil bastard that he turned out to be in the movie. But Robert De Niro is just so hateful in the movie that it's just like, ugh, it just made me cringe.
Yes, it's cringeworthy. But it's also a chapter in American history that people need to be aware of.
That's the point of the movie, exactly. Exactly. Because I didn't know that story.
Yeah,
I didn't know that story.
There's just so many different kinds of stories to be told, and to the point earlier about, you know, there are movies like American Fiction that I can see myself seeing that another five times, you know. But that Basie movie was a good one and done for me, because it's just so heart-wrenching how evil the white folks in that movie did the Osage Indians. I mean, you know, from the lying to their face to actually killing them. And I mean, when they took homegirl and she's saying, you know, you guys go kill me, you gotta kill me. And she's all drunk, and they just, you know, it's just so heartless, you know. And the world that we live in today has enough BS that we're all dealing with, you know, here and abroad, that, you know, a movie like that is just, it's a history lesson, a very well done one. You know, it was long. I agree with Janine. It was a long time to be dealing with evil, mm-hmm. you know, just so, yeah, one and done for that. But yeah, yay, Scorsese, you know, it was one he apparently been wanting to make for a very long time. And so I'm glad that he was able to do that. And people do need to see it one time.
Because it's a part of history that, as we mentioned, people don't know about. But for us as people of color, it ain't new. It ain't new to us. It's or not surprising. A shock.
Right.
That's a Jeffrey Wright dealing with the white student in the class at the beginning of American Fiction.
Yeah. I haven't seen the film, and it's for some of the reasons that all of you pointed out. I mean, the 3.5 hours, it was that. And I really was really ready. And then I was like, wow, that's 3.5 hours. That's long. But then I read about it. You know, I read some of the reviews and everything. And I was like, oh my God, this is going to be another story of death and greed and all of that. And I was like, and that gave me pause, actually. But I still am planning to go see it because it's history. And I like movies that are nonfiction, so I can learn something new. But I was like, man, I don't know if I'm going to be able to take it right now.
Lily Gladstone
understood.
Is awesome in it.
Yeah.
And just to move on to another movie, but carrying that point forward of our pain at how we are treated in this country, I got to see Ava DuVernay's Origin, which is basically a movie about the journey that the author Isabel Wilkerson takes. It's like her personal, physical, emotional journey to writing the book Caste, which is basically about, she proposes that racism is a byproduct of this idea of caste, of a hierarchical society that happens all over the world. And that movie got heavy. And honestly, when I started to watch it, I didn't really know what it was about. I just knew it was Ava DuVernay, and my girl is in it, the actress Anjanou Ellis, who I have to love. And the first scene is a young boy. He's talking on the phone. He's walking in the street in suburbia. He goes into the local 7-Eleven or whatever the store is. And as soon as he puts down a drink and a pack of Skittles on the counter, I'm like, oh no, oh no. This is a Trayvon Martin story. I don't know. I don't know if I could do this. It's too painful. I don't know if I could watch this movie. But as it continued on, the point of view switched to Isabel Wilkerson hearing about that incident and being asked to write about it. And then the story just went from there. But it goes to our ongoing trauma of always being exposed to these stories. Yes, we feel for these very real incidents of brutalization and victimization and racism in this country, but and we're not denying that, but it's hard to keep being beat by it and seeing the images all the time. But I do recommend the movie.
Yeah.
It's a good movie because it's also about her relationships and her process, her writing process of how she does her research and connects the dots. So, But there was a point in the movie where I thought, why? Like, it's painful. Like in, you know, Killers of the Flower Moon, you get to a point in the movie like, why does this keep happening? Why, Lord, why?
I haven't seen the movie, but I have read a couple articles that are about how it is powerful. But for whatever reason, the initial screenings, it doesn't appear to be connecting to audiences. And I think because I saw the trailer several months ago and I was like, wow, I want to see this. And now that it's out, like, I don't hear much, you know, it's been passed over for all the awards so far. It hasn't gotten noticed on anything, which is surprising to me.
So maybe it's too much for people.
Yeah, possibly.
You know, because it doesn't just talk about our trauma as Black people. It talks about Jewish survivors of the Holocaust. It talks about the caste system in India. It talks about oppression in numerous situations, and that gets really heavy because, you know, we have our own burdens to bear, but so do so many others. So moving on, is anybody excited about The Color Purple?
I want to see it. I don't know if I'm excited about it. I want to see it.
Talk about Black trauma.
Y'all are cruel today. Wow.
No. I've seen it many times, obviously. I saw it when it came out when I was much younger. I saw it on Broadway. And quite honestly, I kind of had enough. I was
enough with The Color Purple.
I mean, that is a story that has come so full circle. And I'm one of those people that'll probably lose my Black pass because I've never watched The Color Purple original one all the way through. I've never been able to get through it. I did not read the book. Of course, I did not see it on Broadway. And the only thing that I'm slightly interested in with this new one is the casting and the fact that my girl Brenda Russell was involved in writing the songs for this one. Excited. There's like 12 movies. It's been a long time that there's been this many movies that I want to see in this holiday season when I usually do see a lot of movies. And so it's not really on the list unless I get through everything else. And then it's like, oh, okay, let me check this out. But that's just me. I've never been able to really get behind that. I couldn't get through the first one. Couldn't get through it.
Wow. Get out. You are ejected. No.
My Black.
Scott, could I ask you where you stopped in the film?
It's been so long ago when I was of course much younger. I think I really was bristled at the way the men in that story, and I didn't have the patience that I might have now. I mean, I almost feel like I need to see, you know, make myself sit and watch the original and then compare it with the new one. That would be the me of old that would just kind of make it a personal assignment. But this is not a good time for that because I've got everything from Wonka to Godzilla to Rustin to, I mean, there's so many things I need to see. So that one's just not speaking to me.
I understand. I saw it. And I know that the original 1985 movie, it's a classic, you know, it's widely beloved. And then they turned it into a stage musical, which I didn't see. Now, I love Brenda Russell. That's my girl. Stephen Gray, the late mm-hmm. Allie Willis, brilliant. But
yes,
this film is about female empowerment, but it takes so long to get to her moment of empowerment. And meanwhile, again, we're dragged through all this trauma and sexual and physical abuse, dysfunction, deprivation, jail, all this stuff. It's just tough to take. And then like the music. Now, like I said, I love those writers. I didn't find the music to be, you know, okay, this is what I wrote, like in my notes, you know. The film has foot stomping gut bucket blues numbers, foot stomping spirited gospel numbers, foot stomping anthems full of deep southern spirit, and a whole lot of foot stomping, head snapping choreography to go with it. But it's all like, okay, I already said too much. Like, they're going to come for my black card too. I love Fantasia. I love the casting. I didn't really necessarily want Taraji Henson to be Shug. Okay, some people are going to love this movie. More power to them. It's beautifully shot, beautifully produced. Go with God.
Oprah is going to be mad at you.
Tell us how you feel.
I know. I'm sorry, Oprah. Oh, Lord. Maybe I should edit this out. Okay?
Oprah's going to be.
Yeah, you don't want to make any enemies.
Under your movie seat, and there's gonna be a buy. Everybody else gets, you know, some cookware or a new book or something, and Janine C's gonna have a Wile E. Coyote,
right?
A Wile E. Oprah bomb under it.
Can I mention my favorite movie?
Go ahead.
My favorite movie of the year. I love American Fiction. Was my second favorite movie. My favorite movie of the year is Maestro. I saw Maestro. I saw Maestro about 3 weeks ago, and I was. When I say blown away by Bradley Cooper's performance, like blown away. Like the script is fantastic, but he is so in this character that you forget it's him. Like from beginning to when Leonard Bernstein is an older man. The script is brilliant. Like I said, Carey Mulligan as the wife is great. Sarah Silverman, who I never even thought was as an actor, is really, really good as his sister. It's shot both in black and white for the first half, and then they switched to color toward the end. And it's just like it's 2 hours of solid filmmaking. And I wouldn't be surprised if I think Bradley is probably going to get the he's going to get nominated for sure for an Oscar. But I wouldn't be surprised if he gets it because it's so deserving. It's just a great movie.
That's another one on my list to see. Yeah,
I saw it yesterday.
Wow.
I watched it yesterday, and it is towering achievement, I would say. He does embody Leonard Bernstein. And of course, Leonard was a maestro of our generation. If you knew who he was a public figure. He didn't just stick to classical music. He was also a composer. He did Broadway. You know, he is well known. And West Side Story and Candide is another musical that I happen to love. Did we know this much about his personal life? No, we didn't. And that's what made it really, really interesting. And he's a fascinating character because he had so many dichotomies about his personal life and his drive and his imagination. I do think you need to know a little bit about who he is. Like we may know who he is, but there are going to be people who will come into the movie who'll be like, I have no idea who these people are. I don't know what's happening. What are they saying? Because you get dropped right into his world and there's
a
party scene and it's all this rat-a-tat talk and famous names are being thrown around. So that might confuse you. But stick with it. Stick with it. And as I was telling Anita, like because of the times that it was set in, everybody smoked cigarettes. Now I'm a former cigarette smoker myself. But this movie is going to give you lung cancer just watching it. Seriously. Am I wrong, Jared?
No, for real. It was a smoky movie for sure.
But I love, and also because there were certain little fantasy elements to it, right? Like,
yeah.
Oh my gosh. And the
fact that he did, I mean, it's so mind-boggling that you could act, write, and direct yourself like that to that much perfection. I was just like, I was blown away.
Yeah, I feel like Bradley Cooper is like, he's turning into like this polymath who, you know, everything. You know what? The other thing is I somehow saw a YouTube video of him. This was years ago. I forget that disco era movie he was in where they were.
American Hustle.
Yes.
No, yeah, American Hustle. Yes.
Yeah, American Hustle, which was a good movie, really entertaining. Yeah. But he did a interview in France. He was on a French talk show, and I thought he was going to have an interpreter. He just busted out and started talking in perfect French. And I don't know why that impresses me, but I'm like, this dude is brilliant.
Yeah. He's awesome.
Yeah. He's awesome. It's a good movie. I recommend it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what else is on our list as we wind down?
I can get myself out of the way real quick. Because of me moving away from 2 hours away from Hollywood and all of that to a place that doesn't have a whole lot of movies, I didn't see many. So the only other one that American Fiction is my favorite movie of the year. But before I saw that yesterday, it was Executioner 3. I mean, or no, Denzel, what is that movie?
Equalizer 3.
I did something wrong. Yeah, Equalizer 3. I really enjoyed that. I love seeing Denzel in Italy, you know, saving the little town and just being a badass and all that. It was total popcorn movie, and I enjoyed it. But like I said, I have a good baker's dozen of movies to see within the next couple of weeks, and I'm so happy with the bumper crop. So yeah, I think all I've seen this year was, you know, Killers of the Yellow Moon, the Denzel movie, and now American Fiction. So I'm really behind. And I used to do a lot more stuff. This just wasn't the year for that until now.
Yeah. The other film that I think is Oscar worthy, I hope it gets attention, but it doesn't seem to be generating much, is Rustin. Which George C. Wolfe directed, and I thought it was a little stagey in like it seemed.
Yeah,
like
I can. Yeah, I would just jump in and just say like I liked it, I didn't love it, and the problem with George C. Wolfe is just what you said. Same problem with Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. He directs stuff as if you're on Broadway, and this is not Broadway. This is a film you're going to see, and so I also felt that, and I love Coleman Domingo. Don't get me wrong, I love him. But I felt that he was acting in most of the scenes. I felt that he's good. Don't get me wrong, he's good. But I'm like, I don't know. So I wanted to like it more.
I didn't get that.
Yeah, I totally got it. Yeah.
I thought he was amazing. Like he had these. Obviously, he was not speaking in his own cadence. Like he really had to adopt. You know, this was a real life figure who orchestrated the March on Washington. Like he because of rumors about his sexuality and his relationships, he kind of got drummed out of the NAACP, and he only cried about it for like 2 minutes, and he turned around, okay, well, I'm going to start this March on Washington. I'm going to recruit people to help me set it up, and we're going forward. And he was able to get back all of the the civil rights leaders at that time. He was able to face down the Washington naysayers who were trying to block having this he wanted it to be a 2-day event. They said, no, you can only have a 1-day event. He's like, all right, we'll have a 1-day event, you know. It was awesome. It is a great story that I don't think has been told before, and I would really like to see Coleman get his attention, because he's been working for a while too. But we're starting to really notice him. Really good movie. Anita, anything else on your list?
Like Scott, I have a list.
That you have to get.
Because really, this year, all I saw was, I well, in the movies, it was Equalizer 3 as well. I saw that in the summer, American Fiction. So now that's obviously my favorite movie now. I want to see, I've got to go to see Killers of the Flower Moon. I have to do that. Okay. Maestro, I need to see as well, because again, I like nonfiction. So it's teaching me something. I definitely want to go and see it.
Yeah, it's a great film. And as great as he is, Bradley Cooper, Carrie Mulligan, it is amazing.
She's good. I love her. She's good.
She's really good. The other film that I'm going to mention is May December, which is getting a lot of talk and attention, particularly before the script. And they actually sent me a bound copy of the script. So I think I'm going to look at the script, because the movie kind of left me a little bit cold. It's kind of like a reimagining or a jumping off of the facts of the Mary Kay Letourneau case, where she was a teacher who fell in love with a 13-year-old and ended up going to prison for it. And then she comes out of prison, marries the guy, and now they're having their suburban life. And an actress is going to portray her in an upcoming movie. And so she comes to do research and talk to this woman. And it's just so, both of these characters are so, like, they're a little left to center. They're a little weird. And I think that's where the director Todd Haynes likes to go. These characters. So yeah, December.
Mm-hmm. I told you I couldn't get through it. I couldn't get through the first 15 minutes.
Oh wow.
I know the story, you know, you've seen it on Lifetime, you've seen it on whatever, you know, the specials that they do.
Yeah.
On any network, and it was just like, oh God, no, not this again.
Yeah, that woman is seriously deluded. Like, she's seriously deluded still, you know? And particularly as she's portrayed in this movie, she has a different name. Her name is Gracie. She's not Mary Kay. Right. And the young man, it's Julianne Moore. And the young man who plays her husband is, his name is Charles Melton. He was in The Sun Is Also a Star, which was kind of like a teen romance with Yara Shahidi a couple of years ago.
He's getting all the buzz for supporting actor awards.
Yes.
Charles. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's on the come up. So, but yeah, I don't know. It kind of left me a little cold. So yeah, maybe we'll leave it there. I have other movies that I could talk about, because, you know, I've seen so many movies just in the last 2-3 weeks trying to catch up. And, you know, be prepared to vote in whatever voting I'll be doing.
Have you seen The Holdovers?
I have seen The Holdovers.
Oh, I can't wait to see that.
Okay. Oh, yeah. It was interesting. It was an interesting movie. And I love that actor, that sideways guy.
Paul Giamatti.
Paul Giamatti. He is unbelievable. But the woman, Divine Joy Randolph.
Yeah, she's getting all the buzz. Yeah.
She her character is so refreshing, because she I feel like she looks stereotypical, like she's a big black woman working in the kitchen of this school, you know, this private school, boys school, but there's so many layers to her. And
I can't wait to see it. I cannot wait to see this one. Yeah,
it's good. Another movie that I would talk about, a couple of other movies I mentioned, is Past Lives, which is coming in for the foreign language, even though it's half in English and half in Korean. Mm. It is so beautiful to look at.
Wow.
Oh my God, the cinematography is awesome. And it's just heartrending, because it's about a love that could not be. And it just makes you, it'll make you think about all your past romances. And your missed opportunities, the people who wanted to be with you that you didn't want to be with, the people you wanted to be with who weren't with you, and then those just moments of awkwardness, like when you're with somebody and, you know, like there's all this unspoken yearning and lust, and oh, it's so good. And the other one is You Hurt My Feelings, which is a Nicole Holofcener film. And basically, at its core, it's about thinking of exploring the idea of how many times we shore up our family members, our friends, those we love. You're great, honey. You're a great writer. You are a fantastic. If you did it, it's wonderful. Don't worry about it. You're fantastic. Keep doing it. Even when we might go to ourselves, you know what? They're not that good. They're not that good. But you know what? You keep doing you. It's so good. Julia Louis-Dreyfus is, you know, she's amazing in it. So I guess we can wrap up there. This has been a fantastic conversation. I really enjoyed having you guys on. Thank you so much. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Yeah. Happy holidays, everybody. And Janine, thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. Anita, you going to be on again. You're joining the Words on Flicks team. So
okay. I'm okay with that.
All right, guys. I appreciate y'all to the max.